and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis. I wanted to start this podcast because it felt like there were lots of roles, be it in distribution, marketing, programming, post-production, or even on a film set, that don't get the attention they deserve. Likewise to the women doing those jobs. I'll be interviewing guests on how they got their start in the film industry, what it is they actually do, what keeps them motivated, and what their ambitions are.
Hello, pod pals. I hope everyone is well and taking care of themselves. I had a very slovenly weekend featuring multiple baths, multiple movies, and lots of episodes of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's TV series Crashing, which is a riot, so I do recommend. The podcast is officially in its double digits, which is mad but exciting. They grow up so fast, don't they? For this episode, I've got a wonderful guest in the form of Lauren Dunn. Lauren is a BFI Vision Award-winning producer with a background in production on BBC dramas, independent features, and major music promos, and is also an associate lecturer in filmmaking at Manchester Metropolitan University, as well as a development mentor at Channel 4's Random Acts North and a producer for short flicks, which we come to discuss. So it's pretty wonderful that she spared the time in a very hectic schedule to come and speak to me. Lauren's first feature film as a producer was A Deal with the Universe, an autobiographical documentary from transgender filmmaker Jason Barker, telling the story of a very different kind of pregnancy through the lens of personal archive footage and home video diaries. The film had its world premiere on March 26th at the BFI Flare Festival in London last year, so this seemed like the perfect date to publish this episode. I really loved our conversation because we get into the nitty-gritty of producing, like how you create a budget, what pitching your project is like, the public funding landscape, and how Lauren actually makes a living. We also talked about grander concepts such as revolutionising and diversifying the industry, as well as empowering young people to make their own work and being yourself. I really hope you enjoy this, the 10th episode of Best Girl Grip.
Okay, so I guess I started off like with nothing really to do with film. I thought I wanted to be an actor, and I was really involved in theatre, and I was part of the Bristol Old Vic Young Company.
Oh, wow.
And that sort of really felt like where I wanted to go, and I wanted to be sort of making like fringy type work. I used to go and see loads of really weird plays. Yeah. Bristol's great for that. I'm from just outside of Bristol. They do this great thing called Mayfest, where they put on loads of, it's like the Edinburgh Fringe, but in Bristol, and it's really bizarre work. So I kind of really felt like that's what I wanted to do. And I set up like a theatre company with my mates when I was like 17, and we'd like put on loads of like really like mad plays that people would actually come and see. I honestly don't know why. But I found that it was, what was making it difficult was because we didn't really have like a load of money or anything. So it was a challenge to be trying to get theatres and venues, and actually what became really accessible was filmmaking. And I bought this cheap DV camera, and then we just started filming everything. We were making like loads and loads of films, and I was like, this is pretty cool actually. So I was waiting to be a bit older to apply to drama school, because that was still my plan. I went and did an art foundation, and I was making films all the time there as well. I sort of thought maybe I'll apply to do like some film courses as well, in case the acting thing doesn't happen, like a backup plan. And I got a place at the Manchester School of Art to do filmmaking. And I got waitlisted at Birmingham, the drama school there, which is where I really wanted to go. And I was like, oh God, it's not going to happen. So I went to Manchester, and like in the sort of the first week that I was in Manchester, I got a place accepted at Birmingham.
Oh my goodness.
So, but then I just sort of felt like I was there for a reason then. I don't know, I just had this really, I filled out all the paperwork and addressed the envelope, and to accept my place at Birmingham, just never took it. So yeah, stayed in Manchester, and I didn't really understand anything about the film industry, because all my like knowledge and research and reading and all my references were in theatre, because that's what I spent all my youth kind of involving myself in. So that was a real sort of learning experience for me about trying to build a picture of what the film industry looked like alongside making lots and lots of work.
And where did that creative impulse come from? Did your family work in the arts? How did you get involved in theatre even?
I don't know. My mum was a drama teacher.
Okay.
So maybe that was why. So she was massively discouraging of me being involved in theatre at the beginning. She thought it was really like not a good idea for me to do that. So yeah, maybe that was it. I don't know. I guess that's just something that I'd always always felt, I don't know, like always wanted to do. I always felt quite driven to be inventing stuff, I guess.
And then you continued making films at Manchester.
Yes.
Degree. It was a practical course.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like it's a really brilliant course, and it's the course I actually now teach on.
Right.
It's quite unique in the fact that it's an art school setting.
Yeah.
So there's all different kinds of filmmakers. Some are artist filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, narrative filmmakers. But the emphasis is on just creating lots of work and sort of finding what it is you want to say and expressing yourself, and not so much on like learning how to tie cables and turn cameras on, or, you know, film theory, essay writing and stuff like that.
And you said like you picked up a camera and you were shooting. So
yeah.
How did that kind of spiral into then being a producer and kind of getting a production together?
Yeah, well, when I went to university, I thought, okay, well, maybe this means I want to be a director. Maybe I want to be a cinematographer. I'd also been doing lots of like photography, but then I with the camera stuff, as soon as I got to university, I realized, okay, I'm like way out of my depth already, because it's so techie and not something that was accessible to me at all. It was like way beyond my knowledge and skill set, and I thought it must be directing that I wanted to do. But I really struggled actually in that I loved the idea stage. I loved like talking about the idea and writing the script and like doing the casting and finding the locations. And then actually when I was on set, I kind of just wanted to enjoy being there. And I hated that everyone was asking me questions that I didn't really know the answer to.
Yeah.
And I struggled to see the film in the edit and how all the shots were going to stack up. And it all just felt quite robotic to me. And it wasn't until I was in my final year there that I really started to look at producing. It was something that wasn't really well understood on the course at the time. Part of the reason why I've gone back to teach there, it was sort of seen as the person who could drive and make sandwiches was the producer.
Yeah.
But I sort of realised that actually this was an amazing way to be involved in lots of projects creatively and do all the fun stuff without having any of the horrible on-set responsibility of pressurised questions of where you want the lights and what this person's wearing and all of that.
Completely. And when did you realise or discover that you can make a living out of it?
That's a good question, because I feel like I'm still trying to make a living out of it. And certainly when I graduated, it was a time that the Film Council was disbanding and all the money had gone away. And, you know, I had lots of ideas and I was working with people that I'd graduated with, but there was just no way. And we were making stuff, but we were making stuff for no money, and there was nowhere to get any money from. And I was just like, okay, well, this is sort of the end of the road, really, because there's only so much of that you could do. And I ended up working in TV, and it wasn't until Creative England came back round that I was like, okay, this is my opportunity now to try and get in. And I could see, I just set myself like a year. I was kind of like, I made a New Year's resolution to be more deluded. And I was like, I'm just going to give myself a year to just see like what might happen if I just give it a go.
Yeah,
that's kind of how it started, really. And I think I'm a big fan of like those kind of like timescale goals. I think it could be overwhelming to think, okay, well, how am I going to make my career? Mm. How am I going to keep earning a living? I'm just trying to think about things in small chunks and see what happens, because it's massively hard to make a living in this industry. And it's a concern that all of us have and a big pressure. So I'm trying not to be bogged down by it.
There's something that's come up quite a lot, actually, is the idea of setting a time frame and almost giving an impossible task a tangibility, like the sense that, okay, if it doesn't happen in a year, then maybe reframe it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It takes the pressure off,
exactly.
I think.
Coming back to working in TV, how did that happen? What roles were you doing?
So I was working in production, and it happened because I'd also worked on some low-budget features beforehand, and I met some people on that then gave me an opportunity. I got a job on the Royal Family Christmas special, which was like fun, and then kind of some stuff at CBC and Sky drama, and then a BBC drama as well. And I kind of worked my way up quite quickly. Like every job that I did, I sort of looked at the role above and thought, I can do that. And then I did that and was like, oh, it's actually really hard.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to sort of look at what somebody else is doing and feel like it's easy, and then when you're in their position, it's really not. So yeah, I was coordinating. That was what I was doing at the point that I left. So I was coordinating quite big dramas, but it just wasn't really what I sort of imagined my life to be, and it wasn't really what I imagined filmmaking to be. I really felt like I was just a cog in a machine, and that I was replaceable, and that like I wasn't contributing anything of myself. Like, I found that I was very good at production. I was like, I'm very efficient, I can work very fast, and I'm good at talking to people, and those are all really great skills for production. But I just felt massively undernourished in the fact that none of it was mine, and I just really, really wanted to have a sort of creative stake in something. I just felt like if I was pouring so much time and energy in something, I really wanted it to be a part of me as well.
What, all these roles in Manchester? Your career as a whole has kind of taken place there. That's really interesting to me, because I just think a lot of people at university think to start their lives, to start their career, they have to move to London. It's very London-centric. Was it just that it never occurred to you to move to London, or you just found that there was a creative hub in Manchester, so you never needed to leave?
My plan while I was at uni was to then go to London when I graduated, and I just sort of fell in love with Manchester, really. I think it's an amazing place, and I didn't really want to leave, and especially as there were opportunities that were coming up, I never felt the pressure to go. And certainly when I was working in production, there's so much work that actually we were struggling to crew up on everything that I worked on. We were struggling to crew up. There was more work than there were jobs to, than people to fill the jobs that were available. So I never felt that there was a need for me to move.
And then, is that where Dadaval Film came from? The idea that you wanted to kind of have more of a personal input?
Because I did a stint in music videos as well, sort of alongside the TV stuff. I thought, okay, maybe this is a way for me to kind of have a bit more control and creative influence. And I was working with a really good friend of mine. His name's Singh J. Lee. He's over in LA now, doing absolutely massive stuff. We were kind of making like no budget music videos, and then he started getting big budgets. So I was kind of like, "Hey, yeah." And we were like producing. I was producing. We were working together and like making his stuff. And that was. But again, it's like it's really fun while there's no money involved, because you have a lot of freedom and control. Yeah. But as soon as the record labels were coming in, and it then became something else. And again, you just become a facilitator as a producer. So I think it was a combination of that and of the TV stuff, and also just working so many hours and just feeling like this is just gonna burn me out and I don't feel like it's for anything. I wanted to get back into kind of making the shorts and stuff, where was what I had been doing before.
So did the shorts come first and then you set up the company and the brand, or vice versa?
So like I said, I've sort of been making shorts all the way through this, but not for any money. But then when that Creative England pot of money, which was the first round of iShorts, came back round, I was like, okay, I've got a number of different things I'm working with people, let's put something in. And then when we got the money for the Pig Child, which is the film that we made, I was kind of like, okay, I need a company now. So I kind of just made up a company name, and I was still working as a sole trader until about 3 years ago.
And what does it look like now? How many people work for you?
So I've just got one person working for me. I'd love to have more, but I can't afford that. got an office now, and an infrastructure. And it's real, feels like a real thing, and not just me making films with my mates for fun. I mean, it is still fun, but it's kind of like the dream.
And what does independent producing look like? You know, are you going to the office every day? What kind of hours do you work?
So, like I said, I've like a massive, massive thing about production hours, and having spent so much time doing like 15 hours in the office, I have a real like thing against it. So I don't do that. I tend to work quite normal hours, or do sort of like just 9 to 5 in the office, and if it's quiet, go home early. I don't think there's any merit in just being at the office for hours on end. I think it's much more productive to have like more condensed day, get it done and be productive and go home. So that's kind of what the day is like, I suppose.
And that you speak about working with peers and sort of grappling together budgets to get stuff made. Was there anyone above you that you saw kind of doing it as a living, that was kind of making a career out of it, that you thought, you know, that's who I want to emulate?
Yeah, I suppose a bit. Like when I was at university, we had a visiting lecturer come in, a producer, his name was Mike Knowles. He was just finishing his film, which was called A Boy Called Dad, and he was sort of talking about his process, and he'd made a couple of shorts, and I just sort of felt like if he could do it, then I could do it. And it sort of became a real tangible thing to me to see somebody else going, okay, well, I just wanted to make films, so I did. And I was like, okay, cool, it's possible. So that was a massive driver, I think, in believing that it was something that I could do. And definitely, like, when I was starting out as well, all that stuff about Warp, starting out in the shed in his garden. Mm. I just felt like, yeah, okay, this is really positive and encouraging to me. It felt like it was all possible.
Yeah, like you don't need the big glassy office to kind of
Exactly.
First thing, you can kind of do it small and work your way up. So after doing several shorts, was a deal with a universe your first kind of big feature?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. And so what was that process like, kind of making the switch?
It was kind of amazing and terrifying all at the same time. It was amazing because I had such a brilliant time working with Jason, who's the director.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of fun and it was a really collaborative relationship. It was quite unique in the sense that there was no production. It's all archive footage that was entirely post job. So it became a very sort of like tight group, myself, Jason, the editor, Rachel, and Natasha from Tiger Lily, who was our exec.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of just spent a lot of time together talking, and it was again like making films like you used to when you were a teenager. It was just like a small group and everyone just talking about ideas, and that was really energizing and amazing, and I loved that. But it was absolutely terrifying making a feature film for the first time and not having any idea what I was doing, not having been to like NFTS or having been taught how to do any of the financing or the legals or any of that stuff. I was massively out of my depth and it was very frightening, but kind of got through it. So
did you learn that on the job? Is that
something
you're just like, how do you go about creating a budget when you don't even know?
Yeah, it was really funny because Natasha was brilliant. I honestly couldn't have done the film without Natasha, but I remember talking to her really early on about, like, so I'd never made a documentary before even. I'd only ever made narrative shorts.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know what should go into a documentary budget. And I was talking to her and I was like, can you just tell me what should go in the budget? And she was like, you just draw up a draft and I'll tell you what you're missing. And I was like, can't you just tell me what I need to put in it? Because I don't know. And then I drew it up and sent it to her and she was like, okay, you're missing like everything. So just include this, 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 this. But that, it's just, it's all been a massive learning curve. And again, when you're making shorts, it's sort of, certainly with like iShorts and stuff like that, where the budget was $5,000, it was kind of like, okay, give us the money and we'll just make it work. Whereas with the feature, everyone's like, how much do you need and why? And it was a very different style of budgeting because you're not used to being able to give an actual real cost of things because everything is a deal on a short. So that was quite a weird experience as well, actually having money to pay people. It's nice.
How do you reconcile those kind of two elements of producing? Because obviously, as you say, it's a very creative role and it's obviously very people oriented, but then there's that kind of hard sell and like the pitching side of things, which seems quite antagonistic.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't mind pitching. I know some people will hate it, but I quite like it because for me, I'm only taking on projects that I'm really, really enthused about and really excited about. And for me, it's just an opportunity to tell people about stuff that I think is really exciting. What I hate is all the paperwork. All the money talk, all the financing, all the paperwork, all the legals, all the like scheduling and contracts and all that kind of stuff is the bit that I have to tolerate to do the bit I like to do. Certainly it's not the bit that I love. I'm not like a very business minded person. I'm a sort of creative person.
What's the most rewarding part of it all?
I think undoubtedly the most rewarding part is the collaboration. For me, it's sitting down with a writer, a director, and just talking about ideas, talking about possibility, and, you know, talking about story and where something can go and characters and worlds and all of that. That is just the most amazing part of the job for me, I think.
And what kind of stories are you looking to tell as a producer?
This is really hard. It's always really hard to, like, articulate what you're looking for because to some extent everyone says the same things. Everyone's looking for something that's different. Everyone's looking for something that's original, hasn't been told before. But I guess I'm looking for maybe stuff that challenges. I sort of feel like film is such an amazing tool for change, and I just think it's such a great opportunity to have a story told that means something. I just feel like I want to be involved in stories that are going to have some kind of impact, are going to challenge, are going to inform, are going to change the way people think. I don't think that needs to mean that it then has to be a really dry art house, you know, like worthy film. I don't think so at all. I think actually the best films are the films that are really, really entertaining, really, really engaging, but then also offer you something nourishing as well, that also make you think differently. So, I guess that's what I'm looking for, is that niche. I really, really like thrillers. I think that genre is a great way to kind of discuss really interesting themes.
I was going to say the lambing season is kind of like, it's quite different obviously from a deal with those two kind of things, just stick in my mind as being from opposite ends of the spectrum.
But again, with like with a deal with the universe, for me, when I was talking to Jason, I was just like, this is, it just had to be something that we got made. I just felt so strongly that it was a story that had to be told, because it was saying so many interesting things about gender and actually what we perceive gender to be and how important that is or not important that is. And also, ultimately, it's kind of a love story. And I think it's really important to just have like stories that represent a diverse group of people in a sort of normal way. And the film isn't really about him being trans. Okay, yeah, it's touched upon, but it's really about him wanting to start a family and his relationship with his partner. So yeah, again, like that to me is kind of like taps into that thing of it just, I could see that it was a massively important story that was going to benefit people. I'm being really inarticulate, but yeah, I just felt like it could have an impact at a societal level, a cultural level, that it could make a real impact actually. And really change the way people thought about gender and trans people in particular.
It's really interesting that you talk about change from a narrative level, because I know you're also quite involved in change from an industry level. I obviously spoke to Helen from the podcast a couple of episodes ago about the producers' roundtable. So can you talk a bit about your role in that and where you want to take it, what you want to achieve with it?
Yeah, I think I've always been quite motivated by wanting the world to be right and wanting things to be fairer. And like my friends used to tease me as a teenager that I was too morally, because if I felt like something was wrong, I would have something to say about it. And I sort of felt like, especially in the last few years, I've seen so much more of the industry and kind of really beginning to sort of see a bit deeper into the workings of that. And I was just feeling like it was actually massively unfair. And that's where that kind of conversation came from. It was actually Sophie that put Helen and I together, because we've been talking about similar things. And I didn't know Helen. Sophie sort of knew both of us. And then we all started talking about this thing. And I felt certainly from a producing perspective, so many people that I was talking to were independently wealthy. And it just felt like, actually, this is a job where you really do have to have so much money to just stay in the game. And I just felt like we were excluding a whole group of people, and by excluding them we're also excluding a whole like wealth of talent who don't have any other way into the industry. So yeah, we wanted to kind of look at that and actually with some facts as well, and like do some research into what the reality of the situation was and what was like the perception we had accurate or not.
And you found that it is accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to released the report soon. We've been having really great conversations with BFI and BBC, have been really supportive of kind of the research we've been doing, and are interested to sort of see the results as well. So we will publish those, but it does really show that there's a lot of privilege amongst producers. There's a lot of privilege, but also it really highlights that producers aren't really making any money. There's a disconnect between the fact that there's a large expenditure for producers to keep their business running and keep projects on the slate, and the fact that actually it's very hard to make money. So I think until things change, that's just kind of perpetuating this problem of it being a rich man's game, really. And certainly with the roundtable, outside of the survey and all the kind of research we've done, we do have regular meetings. We have about like 30, 40 people come to every session, and I think it's something that actually people have been really desperate for, is just a kind of safe forum to kind of chat and air concerns and ask questions about rates and legals, and that's really good. And we're talking as well about how we can better support new producers coming in, and we're trying to say it's okay to have this conversation, because I think for so long producers have felt the pressure to know everything, or at least appear to know everything, and have felt quite nervous about asking questions, certainly of funders and execs, because you don't want to show that you're limited in knowledge, and you don't want to risk not being funded again. You don't want people to think, oh god, no, she doesn't know anything. But actually, I think that's a fear producers have, maybe unfoundedly, and I think actually that spooks funders less than producers think. So we're trying to really make it a safe space to be like, okay, I actually don't know how to do this, and how would I know how to do this, because everyone's learning on the job.
Do you make your livelihood from public funding? Is that how you subsist?
Yeah, I mean, like, certainly for me, the Vision Award has been absolutely life-changing, and there's no way I could be doing what I'm doing now without that. And I think that's also partly why I kind of want to say something about this now while I can and while I'm here, that if it hadn't been for that, I'd probably be squeezed out by this point, because I just financially couldn't have stayed in the game. So yeah, I'm just kind of hyper aware that there might be other people who weren't as lucky as me who are then missing out on the opportunity to kind of have this career just because they're not born into the right family or have the right kind of money.
Can you talk about the Vision Award and what it is and how you got
it? Yeah, so the Vision Award is an award from the BFI. It's essentially slate funding and also contains a grant element to support you as an individual to kind of pay your salary and any business costs that you have. I'm going to my third year of that funding now, and it really enables me to have this as my main job. I can employ somebody to come and work with me, and that I can take projects on. I can fund those projects at a kind of an early development level with autonomy and not having to go through any public funders.
And what does revolution look like in the terms of trying to bring more people into the industry? How can we manifest that? It's a big question.
Oh, I love revolution. I've got to be careful. I feel like all I'm doing is shouting about revolution. I'm trying to not be too aggro. What does revolution look like? That is a hard question. I think ultimately it's got to be about representation. It's got to be about us all looking really long and hard at the stories that are out there. And we have a huge responsibility as people in this industry to be reflecting a range of different voices and stories that say something about the world that isn't already being said. And I think definitely that shift is starting to happen. I think actually the films that are coming out as a result of that are like massively interesting and a change from what we've seen over maybe the last 20 years, but I suppose forever, that where the industry's sort of been dominated by white middle class straight men. But yeah, you change the people at the top, and you help change producers as well, who are, you know, the people who are bringing in the projects, and you'll open up a whole wider range of diversity and more interesting stories, because there's so much out there. And I think we all love to hear stories from people that have different life experiences to us and tell us something of the world that we don't know or that we haven't experienced. So I think that's what we should be looking at. I think that's what revolution looks like, I guess, mm-hmm. is really empowering those people to have a place in this industry.
And is that part of what you want to do, what lecturing at Manchester School of Art is about?
Yeah, I mean, like, definitely. So with the School of Art, I went away and did some work in the industry, and I learned so much. I really kind of wanted to come back and say, like, this is what producing is, actually, because that was really missing while I was there. And I feel so strongly about what an amazing job, you know, being a producer is, that I wanted to come back and offer that insight to students. And I never left, and they sort of made me a permanent member of staff there after doing like some guest lectures. So yeah, I mean, like, I definitely see my role there. I work only with the final year students. I definitely see my role there as a transitional role to help them move from...
Shepherding them in.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm really all about empowering them to feel able to go and do stuff. I think if somebody feels like they can do something, they will at least try and go and do it. But I think if it's all about attitude, isn't it? It's weird how much like your mindset influences what you think you're capable of and what you actually are capable of. Sorry, I'm rambling.
No, I love that.
So,
I completely believe that.
So yeah, I do a number of things with them. I do like, firstly, I do sort of like a producer's research lab. So in their final year, they pick a specialism, and then I'll run like sort of specialist masterclasses on producing with them, which is always fun. Yeah. I do like a script lab, so they can all come in for like a drop-in, and I'll read their scripts and help develop their scripts. So that's sort of like the bread and butter of what I do with them. But I also facilitate a third year production company, where I help the students put together their own production company. They build a website, social media presence, and then they put on a film festival at home cinema in Manchester and invite a load of people down. And it's really supposed to be about showing them that actually they can really do whatever they want to do and actually have a lot of power to kind of just make things happen. And every year they're kind of very nervous to sort of embark on that. And are really looking for me to like lead them and help them. And by the end, they've got so much confidence, and you can see they feel amazing at having achieved this. And all the kind of hard stuff at the beginning where I'm like really trying to wean them off that kind of tutor-student relationship and being like, no, this is yours. Like, if it fails, it's your fault. And if it succeeds, it's your success. So I think that has a massive impact on them. And they go on then to do really interesting stuff. And many of them are running their own companies and making films. And I do think that's because they feel like they can. So like also this year I've run like a talent lab with them. So we did 2 weeks of like masterclasses and workshops and screenings. We had like Deborah Haywood come in and Jason Wood from Home and a bunch of other people, Alice Ramsey from Film Hub North, come in and talk to them and just kind of really try and inspire them about what the industry looks like and what possibilities are out there, but also the sort of realities of how hard it is. Because I think the really bad reputation that film graduates have is that they come out and think, right, well, I'm going to go direct my, you know, BBC drama now, which is obviously not going to happen. Mm. And certainly somebody who spent like 5 years working in production, I see a massive value in doing that and that kind of like paying your dues thing. But it's not to lose sight of what the goal is. If you have a dream or you have a goal or you have a vision of something that you want to do, just remembering that that is possible.
What's your goal? What is your producing ambition?
Take over the world. what is my goal? I don't know. That's really frightening. My goal for so long was just get a feature made. That was like, so now I've done that, it's kind of, yeah, that's really opened it up. Yeah. I just want to be making really great work. I just want to be making films that feel really authored and really engaging, exciting films, dynamic films that people want to go and see, but then also leave you with loads to talk about and that feel like they have an impact and make people think. So I guess I'm just looking to make good work, better work, I guess.
And what's the biggest career lesson you've learned?
This is such a hard one as well. I think something I learned fairly early on was that it's so much about being yourself. When I started out and I was kind of applying funding and I was like doing all of that, I thought I had to be somebody else. And certainly in meetings or like funding meetings or like I did Triangle many moons ago. It was like, I was in like 2010, which was a Screen Yorkshire scheme. And I sort of felt, okay, like now I'm here, I've got to be this version of what a producer is supposed to be and be like really important and wear really smart clothes and talk the talk. But actually it's really not about that. It's not about putting on a pretense of this of somebody that you're not. It's so about being who you are. And actually that's the biggest asset you have, is just who you are. And that defines your work and the way you work and what projects people want to invest in as well. It's about you. So I think that's definitely a big lesson that I learned, is just to be comfortable in who I was, and that, yeah, I was never going to be like the guys who go in all the like smart suits or like women with like loads of really amazing makeup and high heels. That was never going to be me. But actually, that's maybe my best asset.
You talk about like Screen Yorkshire and obviously we spoke about Creative England earlier. What do you find the state of public funding to be like at the moment?
I think it's amazing at the moment. Like, honestly, I like say to my students, like, this is like the best time to graduate ever. I feel like there's a real boom at the moment, and also a real focus on looking outside of London and looking at different kinds of talent. So I think it's a really, really great time to be making work with the public funders, more so than it has been at any other point in my career. The public funders are a real beacon for all UK filmmakers, and definitely the first place you go to kind of talk about your ideas. And there's definitely a feeling out there that there's a lot of support from the public funders in a way that it's a different relationship with private financiers, where it's much more business and money orientated. Mm. That actually the public funders are more aware of, yeah, wanting to tell an authored story.
What do you think is the biggest misconception around what a producer does?
There are so many misconceptions of what a producer does. I don't think anyone really knows what a producer does. So I'm still learning what a producer does. I remember I was in Berlin a few years ago and I went to one of like the Berlin talents sessions, and it was producers. It was called Producers Sharing Their Secrets. It's actually so good. But there was a guy there and he's talking, he's saying that he thinks a producer does three things. There's like, well, you know, there's three types of producers. There's your creative producer, your nuts and bolts producer, who's like really good at like on set and putting deals together and crewing up and that kind of stuff. And then your like money financial producer, who's really great at like bringing the money and the finance. And he was like, you can't be all three, and that's okay, basically. And about talking about collaboration and teaming up with other producers. So I think there are lots of different types of producers, and producers define themselves in different ways. I think maybe the archetypal, like, age-old caricature of producer is somebody with loads of money, you know, I'll make you a star. that kind of person who's just going to throw money at a project and then make it happen. I think for most of us as independent producers, that's not the reality. I think most of us are coming from more of a sort of creative leaning. And certainly for me, like, I see my strength in the creative and in the collaboration. I like to be involved in projects really early on. Like, I'm the most excited about something that's really, really new, like that is really early on in development, that I feel like I can be involved in that process. And I feel like that's what I'm good at, which is bad for business because it takes a really long time for those projects to get made. So yeah, I think the biggest misconception is that producers aren't good at creative stuff, that story comes only from writers, and that maybe producers give notes, but they can't be invested in the story, and they can't shape the way the film looks and feels. That's kind of the best bit about it for me.
So do you like to have projects at various different stages of development, so that you sort of have one that's ready to go as you're onboarding the next one?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's definitely the ideal model. Yeah. The sort of truth and reality of that is slightly different. I mean, the ones that you feel are sort of ready to go end up taking a bit longer, and then certainly like the deal with the universe, that just went from 0 to 100 like overnight. That was one that I was coming up behind other ones that I thought were ready to go. So you never really know what's going to go. I think definitely with documentary, and certainly with that one, it made us a lot more nimble in sort of just getting out there and getting it made. With like narrative stuff, the development can be so long that you feel like it's just kind of a never-ending process.
Is that because there's so many different opinions in the mix, or why is it that development can sometimes be so protracted?
Do you know what? I'm not sure, and I think it would benefit from actually just being a bit less restrictive. I think certainly working with the like note givers and the execs, everybody wants the film to be the best version that it can be. And certainly, like, as the filmmakers, you know, myself and writers and directors, we really take those on board, and we really want to work on the script and for it to be the best that it can. But also, I think if we relaxed a little more about that and just let people go out and make work, actually that might be really interesting as well. And it might not mean that it's going to be a bad film, that actually you learn a lot in doing. I think you look at somebody like Javier Dolan, who did like Tom at the Farm, yeah, and Mummy and all that kind of stuff. He was just making so much work that you think if people had an opportunity to make work in that way, like, who would they turn out to be? That actually gives you a lot of confidence to be able to go and make stuff. Mm. I'm not saying like a first draft, go and make it, but I think development can feel really demoralizing, mm, especially when they're writer directors, because they just want to make stuff, and it can feel like everybody else is making stuff and they're not getting a chance to, mm, which I know is an inaccurate perception because they've probably been developing stuff for years and years and years and years as well. But
in situations like that where it sort of feels like the green light is never coming, how do you stay motivated?
Again, I think it's about the ideas, and I think that's also what I'm good at. I'm an ideas person, so meeting up to talk about the script with a writer or a writer director, I always find that that's a really good way to kind of remember why we're doing the film and to get excited about why we're making the film, why we want to tell that story. So I think as long as those conversations keep happening and you're still inspired and kind of consumed by the story that you're involved in, then I think that then it continues to be something that you want to make. And
can you ever see yourself switching into directing?
No. I've thought about writing, yeah, in the past. I was like, maybe I'm a writer as well. And I've like started writing stuff, but it's so hard to finish stuff. I've got so much respect for writers because having an idea is easy. It's so easy. But actually writing it, that's a whole different ballgame. And certainly like something I'd like to do more of in the future is having my own ideas about films, but bringing the team to work alongside that.
Yeah.
Rather than wanting to write it or direct, yeah, it myself.
It's almost
I think.
Like a writer's room. It's like the TVs have like showrunners where it's your, yeah, idea and it's your baby, and then you create the team around that.
Yeah, yeah.
What is a film that you've seen recently that is at its undervalued gem?
See, like, I knew you were going to ask me this, and I was looking at this on the train down, and it's still hard because as soon as anybody asks me anything I've seen, my mind goes immediately blank, and then the second I leave this room, I'm going to think of 1,000 really great examples. When I was thinking about this, there, like, film really stands out to me was Revenge.
Yes, the is it Coralie? I can't pronounce her surname.
I know, yeah. I mean, she's French, isn't she?
Forget or something like that.
But I was like, whoa, this is impressive. I think partly because I didn't know anything about it when I went to see it. I went to see it because it was obviously the bird's eye view screen, reclaim the frame. So I didn't know anything about it at all. And I was kind of just really blown away that a woman was making a rape revenge film. And I was kind of like, yeah, kudos, actually. That's kind of sick. And she totally owned it. I thought she did an amazing job. But I also thought it was really interesting, certainly at home in Manchester, the Q&A after the film was heated. There were some really big opinions in the room. And I thought that was really interesting as well. And I think, you know, it's talking about like a film wanting to provoke conversation and be a talking point. That was an amazing thing that everyone then was, it was the whole room was like this massive, very heated debate about everything that was in the film. And I was kind of like, surely that's what film is about. It's yeah. making us reassess things.
Mm-hmm. And is there someone that you've worked with or, yeah, a woman working behind the scenes that you want to spotlight?
Do you know who I love and I think is absolutely amazing is Rachel Clark. She's a DP. So she's worked for years as Robbie Ryan's like wing woman and is like focus pulled on American Honey and loads of stuff. And then she also has done absolutely massive films like Fast and the Furious and Fantastic Beasts. She shot a whole bunch of shorts we made for Short Flicks scheme last year. And I just think she's like amazing. She's incredible. And like, not only is her work visually really striking, but she's just such a down-to-earth, warm person. And, like, grafter too. She, like, totally mucks in. Like, we were shooting those Sky Shorts, Short Flicks, and all the camera training was sort of, like, loading up the boxes. And normally a DP would just sort of walk out and be like, see you later. And then she was there sort of, like, helping them pack all the boxes and load the van. And I was just like, yeah, that's really cool. So I think she's somebody that's going to blow up. I think she's going to be a big... She's about to shoot her first feature as well. So,
as a DP?
As a DP,
oh,
yeah.
Amazing. Can you talk a bit about Short Flicks, actually? I realise that's something we've admitted.
I got involved because I thought it just sounded like such a fantastic scheme. I'd never seen anything like it. Mm. So it was Carolina Giametta. It was her idea. She'd been working with National Youth Theatre on something similar, but with, like, plays and getting people to write their own stuff and put stuff on. Playing Up, I think it was called. So this was like a film version of like finding people that had no current links to the industry, had come from a non-traditional filmmaking background, that had an interesting story to tell, and then giving them the opportunity to get out there, make a professional film with a professional producer and a professional crew around them, and then the film goes out on Sky Arts. So I thought it just sounded so great and I really, really wanted to be involved. So yeah, I got involved. There were about 300, 400 applications and they were whittled down to 25. We then developed the 25 projects between all of us. There was a number of us kind of execing at that point. Then the filmmakers pitched to Sky and five films were commissioned. But then did an absolutely mad production stint where we shot five shorts in 2 weeks.
Whoa.
Back to back.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, because the budget was limited and it was the best way to get the most out of the money, because then we just booked people out on a 2-week buyout and the same with the kit, and we were all over the country. We were in Bath, we were in London, we were in Sheffield, and it was kind of nuts. And the way we'd structured it as well is we had 2 days a rest day, 2 days a rest day, but then also the rest day became the travel day, the wrap day and the prep day. So and certainly when we started, I imagined that I'd have more support in production, but then when it came down to it, the money was just so tight we just couldn't afford to do it. So it was myself and my coordinator at the time, we just kind of did all the heavy lifting. So it was just us two in production kind of making all of it happen. So it was a bit like going to war in that it was just a constant onslaught of a barrage of production problems that never ended. But actually what came out of it was quite special, I think. I had a real thing of like, I didn't want it to just be like, okay, because the budget's tight and they're first time filmmakers and everyone had very sort of conservative expectations of what they might make. And I just didn't want to play into that and I didn't want to be really safe and be like, oh, we'll get them, you know, like a 5D and like, we'll just, you know, it's like, you know, kids making their film. I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to give them a proper experience that anyone else, you know, any other writer director I worked with would have. Mm. And all the crew we brought in were really sensitive to that as well, and they knew that they were first-time writers, directors, yeah, first thing they'd ever made, and they were really supportive of that and really respectful and put in loads of extra time to kind of meet with them and do loads of, like, prep with them and stuff. But yeah, certainly out of that, I guess the person that is maybe on people's radar, Luna Carmoon, yeah. So she's obviously, like, the film she made, Nosebleed, played at London, and then she's been over in Sundance. And I think, I just feel like that's what the scheme was all about. Like, this is somebody who would have no way of ever making a film or even knowing where to start. In fact, I was talking to her yesterday and we were talking about this, and somebody had asked her, would you have just applied to sort of like the BFI fund, you know, or like Film London, or, you know, like if Shoreflix hadn't come on. She was like, I don't even know what that is. Like, I wouldn't have even known how to, like, email somebody.
Yeah.
So I think that's what that scheme was about. That's taking somebody who has an amazing, like, voice and being like, yeah, let's do it. What Shoreflix did very well was targeting, like, social media and platforms, channels, and, like, some, like, blogs and websites and stuff picked up news about the scheme that then sort of transcended the usual channels. It's a job of the producer too. It's like, producers should be out there talking to people and meeting with people, and certainly, like, for regional producers, talking to people in the community about who's out there, who has interesting stories.
That back-to-back shoot kind of threw up the question of how, when the job is so insane, and especially when you're a one-woman company or you kind of work with one other person.
Yeah.
How do you take care of yourself?
That is something I'm still learning, definitely, because I think certainly when you're running your own company, you pour so much of it in. It's like you and the company are sort of like one. Mm. It's really hard to differentiate. And I think employing somebody was actually really good way for me to realize how much I was working in the way that, like, we'd go home from the office and then I'd still be emailing her, Fran, my coordinator. She's now at British Council, but yeah, like, I'd just be emailing her, like, you know, like, 7 emails every night at sort of like 10 p.m. 11 p.m. and I was like, oh, this is kind of not on actually. Like, although we're not at the office, this is just gonna be, yeah, so stressful,
still working,
but
yeah.
Yeah, but I hadn't actually realized that I was doing that. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so easy to just sort of, you're sitting at home on the sofa and then the email comes in and you just want to deal with it then and there. And so I'm trying really hard to balance that. And also, like, I've absolutely ruined my back over the last, mm-hmm, like, 4 years. So that is something that everyone is, you know, from a sort of like a medical side, is like screaming at me to stop sitting in the chair so much, stop coming down to London on the train so much, and like stop doing so much. So I'm trying really hard to pull back.
Yeah, when you have kind of so much on your plate, is it about delegating more? Like, do you just have to tell yourself no at the end of the day?
I've started saying no this year, yeah, to like a lot of shorts, which is, I'm finding really, really hard, because there are loads of people who I think are amazing who are like, have been coming to me with shorts, people I'd really, really like to work with, that I can't, there's just not enough time to push ahead with features, and do shorts, such a time drain. Certainly doing short flicks last year, I was kind of like, this has got to be sort of the end of this, really, because it just takes you massively off the grid and there's no real sort of financial sense in it either. Mm. Although you do get to work with brilliant new talent, yeah, you've got to also think about how you're going to keep the company running and also what the long-term goals are of feature making.
Brilliant, that's been really insightful. Thank you so much, Erin.
Cool, no worries.